Well, hello and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew would like to once again thank you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. And this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. Allow me to introduce the presenter for tonight's program. Her name is Joy Jackson. Yep, she needs no introduction, to be honest with you, ladies and gentlemen, because everybody should know who Joy Jackson is. But for those of you who don't, there she is. And she will be presenting for tonight's program. So if everyone could just please sit back, grab your favorite drinks and snacks, and enjoy the program. Joy, the microphone is yours.
Thanks, Louise. Welcome to another MSS edition of Treasures Old and New from American Radio Theater. Last October, I played When the World Screamed, a Professor Challenger adventure. This time, I'm playing the second Challenger show that ART has done. Both were adapted by Cole Hornaday from the writings of Arthur Conan Doyle. Here's Professor Challenger in The Poison Belt.
I'm Ted Malone, newspaper reporter. It was a typical morning at the London Daily Gazette as I made my way around the open desks of the city room, last battlement before the office of Mr. McCarthy, our editor-in-chief.
Well, lad, I fear it's fallen to you to interview that old devil down to Rotherfield.
You don't mean Professor Challenger, Mr. McCarthy?
Aye, just the one. Honestly, our boys would sooner interview a loose alligator in the zoo. But Malone, you could do it, being that you are an old friend and fellow explorer.
Why, it was to request a leave of absence in order to visit Professor Challenger that I came by.
Capital.
The fact is, Mr. McCartle, it's the anniversary of our South American adventure, and the professor's asked our whole party down to his house to celebrate.
Splendid. You'll be able to get his opinions. In any other man, I'd say it was all moonshine. But the fellow has made good once, and he may be so again.
Get what out of him, sir?
Why, haven't you seen his letter on scientific possibilities in today's times?
No, I'm afraid not.
Here, read it aloud. I'll be glad to hear it again, for I'm not sure now that I have Professor Challenger's meaning clear in my head at all.
Sir, I have read with
great amusement, not wholly unmixed with annoyance, the wholly fatuous letter of Mr. James Wilson McPhail, which lately appeared in your columns, upon the subject of the blurring of Fraunhofer's lines. Now, McPhail dismisses the matter as no significance. To a wider intelligence, it may seem of very great possible importance, so great as to involve the ultimate welfare of every man, woman, and child upon this planet. To clarify the situation by the use of a homily analogy that, I pray, will be within the limits of the intelligence of our readers.
Bloody wonder that Professor Challenger is, Malone. He'd put up the feathers of a sucking dove and set up a riot in a Quaker's meeting.
Suppose, if you will, that our solar system is but a small bundle of connected corks that was launched in a sluggish current upon a voyage across the Atlantic. The corks drift slowly from day to day with the same conditions all around them. They might possibly float up against a ship or a sleeping whale or become entangled in seaweed. Deep in this ocean of ether in which we are currently floating, might the current not drift us into belts of ether that are novel and have properties of which we have never conceived? From my observation, there is a change somewhere. For good or ill, we do not know. But the wisest man is he who holds himself ready for the unexpected. For instance, the mysterious and nigh universal outbreak of illness noted in your pages this very morning as having broken out upon the Isle of Sumatra. Could it not bear a connection to such a cosmic change? I assert it, is an unimaginative numbskull who is too dense to perceive that it is well within the bounds of scientific possibility. Yours faithfully, George Edward Challenger.
What's your opinion, Mr. Malone?
Well, I must confess my total ignorance of the subject of the blurring of Frauenholder's lines.
Look here, Malone. See this range of spectral bands right here?
Yes.
And these black crossbars bisecting the colors here near the end?
Yes.
Those black bands are Frauenhofer's lines. Huh. The colors just represent light itself. It is these black bands that count. They act as a barometer and vary according to whatever produces the light. These lines have begun to blur over this last week.
Well, has the public taken any interest in this change?
Nay, the public has had no interest in the matter. But this letter of Professor Challenger's in the Times will make them wake up and see the light, I'll wager.
And this outbreak of disease in Sumatra?
Aye, it's a far cry from some blurred lines on a sheet of paper to an epidemic in the tropics. But that brute force of nature knows of which he speaks more than any other man on the continent.
Mr. Malone, sir, a telegram for you.
Who's it from, boy?
Professor Challenger, sir.
Speak of the devil.
Malone, secure for us one tank oxygen before departure to Rotherfield. Challenger. Oxygen? Why? Whatever for?
Young Ted Malone.
Ah, hello, Professor Summerlin.
Oh, don't tell me you received one of those preposterous telegrams calling for oxygen as well. Why could he not order it direct?
As I commenced to reacquaint myself with my former traveling companion, the Challenger's now world-famous lost world, an unusual sight drew our attention from several platforms down the line.
Not another row. What has gotten into Londoners today? Why, in the taxi ride over, we twice nearly had collisions with other vehicles steered by equally erratic drivers. Oh, Lord Roxton, John Roxton.
Hello, Herr Professor Summerlin. Hello, Malone, young fella. have you two become oxygen suppliers as well?
Well, have you read Professor Challenger's letters in the Times? Something related to his current theory, I
imagine. Oh, stuff and nonsense.
Gentlemen, I believe they are calling us to action.
Challenger is a clever man, we've all conceded. Why, look at his hat. There's a 60-ounce brain inside it. A big engine running smooth, turning out clean work. But he is a born charlatan. You've heard me tell him so to his very face. A born charlatan, with a dramatic flair for putting himself in the limelight. Things have been too quiet of late, so friend Challenger is undoubtedly aching to hear the public talking about him. Good God, you don't imagine he actually believes the stuff and nonsense about it. Change in the ether and danger to the human race.
Once we found our way to our first-class smoker, Professor took his seat like an old white raven, croaking and shaking with laughter.
What's there ever such a cock and bull story in this life?
A wave of anger passed through me as I listened to Summerlin carrying on, so it was aggravating to hear him speak thus of a leader who had been the source of all our fame and given us such experiences as no man had ever enjoyed. I was on the verge of a hot retort when Lord John interjected.
You and Challenger have had your shares of scraps, but each time you found yourself down for the count in seconds. Confess it, Herr Professor. That great ape is outside your weight class.
Besides, Professor Challenger has been a good friend to every one of us. Whatever his faults may be, he is as straight as a line, and I don't believe he ever speaks evil of his comrades behind their backs.
Well said, my lad. Come here, Professor, and we're not going to quarrel at this time of day. We've seen too much together.
Perhaps, but I have my own judgment, sir, and I use it my own way.
I felt my aggression toward the old professor begin to bubble and rise like something hot and molten.
I tell you, sir, that I have a brain of my own. If it pleases you to believe this rigmarole about ether and lines upon the spectrum, do so by all means. Do not ask one who is older and wiser than yourself to share in your folly.
But have you not heard, sir, of the great illness spreading across Sumatra? The lights that remain unlit across the Strait of Sumatra.
Stuff and nonsense.
It's no folly, Professor. Summerlee, my editor received a telegram.
Oh, greatly, there should be limits to human folly. Do you for an instant suppose that there is an English ether and a Sumatran ether? Perhaps you believe the ether in Kent is in some way superior to the ether of Surrey.
I don't profess to be a scientific man, though I have heard somewhere that the science of one generation is frequently the fallacy of the next.
Easy, lad. Now, the professor must concede that it doesn't take much common sense to see something strange is going on in various parts of the world and might show an effect over there which would only develop here later on.
When applying words like might and may to your argument, you can prove just about anything. Pigs may fly. Yes, sir, pigs may fly, but sadly, they don't. And so ends the argument. Professor Challenger has filled you both with his nonsense, and you've become incapable of reason.
I must say, Professor Summerlee, that your manners do not seem to have improved since I last had the pleasure of meeting you.
Stuff and nonsense! You lordlings are not accustomed to hearing the truth, and your title offers you little aught but ignorance.
Upon my word, sir, if you were a younger man, you would not dare to speak to me in so offensive a fashion.
I would have you know, sir, that young or old, there has never been a time in my life when I was afraid to speak my mind to such an ignorant cock.
Like a wave, past memories of our former good comradeship began to wash over me. That it should have come to this, insults and abuse. Suddenly I was sobbing and loud, gulping, uncontrollable sobs which refused to be concealed.
Oh, come, lad, it's not all that.
Oh, buck up now, young fella.
It's such a pity.
You're ill, young fella. That's what's amiss with you. I thought you'd come over queer when we met on the platform.
You need not waste your sympathy, Lord John. These tears are purely alcoholic. This man has been drinking. Oh, by the way, Lord John, I called you a coxcomb just now, which was perhaps unduly severe, but it put me in mind of a small talent which I possess. Did you know that as a schoolboy, I once had a well-deserved reputation as a grade-A farmyard imitator? Perhaps I can help to pass the time by sharing with you some of my better impersonations. Oh, try my coxcrow.
Surely you jest.
My imitation of the clucking hen having just laid an egg was considered rather above average in its day, too. Might I venture?
My word. poor devil, he's gone mad as a hatter, but strangely, it puts me in mind of a safari I'd taken with a certain Indian Raja. We'd struck out early one dawn. The sky was a molten umber color, just spectacular. And I vividly recall the Raja's porters adorned in matching pajamas of a very natty purple silk. Completely inappropriate for a jungle fair, I must say so myself.
And now for my North American canary.
All the field station. All out for all the field station.
Well, it was I who disembarked first, drying my eyes with my handkerchief still shaking from my bout of the spontaneous hysterics. I lifted my eyes to find Professor Challenger himself awaiting us. At the platform.
Young Malone, why, whatever is wrong?
Yeah, and that's when I reminded the Raja that the adult male water buffalo is known to charge when fired upon. You don't say, said his majesty. Well, I do say, quoth I.
Professor Challenger simply greeted the three of us with an amused handshake, an encouraging smile, and a strangely enigmatic look. He then quietly helped us to carry our bags and cylinders of oxygen to his large motor car, chauffeured by the ever-impassive Austin. Our journey led us up a winding hill and out into the beautiful countryside. I sat in front with Austin, but behind me, my three companions seemed to be all talking at once. Though I did my ever best to ignore the dull roar in my back, I could not help but make out the sounds of a fierce scientific debate. Professor Summerlee, on occasion, punctuating his arguments with a spontaneous turkey cobble or cockscrow. And all the while, Lord Ruxton struggled on with his perpetually epic tale of the Raja and the water buffalo. It was then that Austin slanted his mahogany face toward me and, without taking his eyes from the road, said,
"I'm under notice."
"Dear me, whatever for?"
"Not certain, really. This will be my 47th time."
"Everything seemed so strange today. Everyone said queer, unexpected things. It was like a dream. Why? When do you go?"
"I don't."
"But then why?"
"If I was to go, who would look after him? Who would he get to serve him?"
"Someone else."
"No, sir. No one would stay a week. If I was to go, that house would run down like a watch with the mainspring out. I wouldn't have the heart. He and the missus would be like two babes left out in a bundle. I've served him for 10 years, and I'm very fond of him. And, mind you, he's a great man when all's said and done. It's an honor to serve him."
And before I knew it, the habitually taciturn Austin was weeping like a schoolgirl, to a most contagious effect.
"Good God, what's come over you two? Show some bloody restraint!"
We reached the Challenger estate, passing up the curving drive lined with rhododendron bushes, and behind stood a low brick house decked out with white woodwork, very comfortable and pretty. Mrs. Challenger, a dainty, smiling figure, stood in the doorway to welcome us.
"Well, my dear, here are our visitors. We don't get many visitors here. No, no love lost between our neighbors and us, is there, dear?"
"It's dreadful, dreadful. George is always quarreling with everyone. How are we having a friend in the countryside?"
"Well, it simply enables me to concentrate all my attention upon my incomparable wife."
And with that, Professor Challenger passed his short, thick arm about Mrs. Challenger's waist, pressing his hairy face against her alabaster cheek. The Challengers were quite a pair, an hirsute gorilla and winsome gazelle in human form.
"Come, these gentlemen are tired from their journey, and luncheon should be ready. This way, gentlemen." "Now, tell me, did you observe anything unusual upon your journey from town?"
"The only thing that I observed was that our young Malone here has not improved in his manners during the years that have passed."
"Well, Summerlee, we all tend to get a bit prosy sometimes. The young fellow meant no real harm. After all, he's an international, so if he takes half an hour to describe a game of football, he has more right to do it than most folks."
"Half an hour to describe a game? Why, it was you, Lord John Ruxton, that took up the entire train ride, some long-winded story about a water buffalo. Professor Summerlee will be my witness."
"I can hardly judge which of you was the most utterly wearisome. I declare to you, Challenger, I never wish to hear of footballs or water buffaloes as long as I live."
"I never said one word about football."
"So early in the day, too. It is indeed deplorable. As I sat there in sad but thoughtful silence..."
"In silence? Why, Summerlee, you were doing a music hall turn of barnyard imitations the entire way."
"You are pleased to be facetious, Lord John, to be sure."
"Why, dash it all, this is clear madness. Each one of us seems to know what the others did, and none of us knows what he did himself. Let's put it all together from the first. We got into a first-class smoker, that's clear, ain't it? And then we began to quarrel over Professor Challenger's letter in the Times."
"Oh, you did you?"
"You said, Professor Summerlee, that there was no possible truth in his contention."
"Our worthy Summerlee is, not for the first time, somewhat out of touch with the facts of the situation. Now, gentlemen, I cannot make my point better than by detailing to you what I have myself done this morning. For several years, we have had in our service a housekeeper, one Sarah, a woman of severe and forbidding aspect. Now, as I sat alone at breakfast, it suddenly entered into my head that it would be entertaining, perhaps instructive, to test the limits of the woman's imperturbability. I devised a simple but effective experiment. Having upset a small vase of flowers, I rang the bell, and slipped under the table. As Sarah leaned over to replace the vase, I protruded my head and sank my teeth into the calf of her leg.
Good God, Challenger. Such nonsense.
The experiment was successful beyond belief. For some moments, she stood paralyzed, staring at my head. Then, with a shriek, she tore herself free and rushed from the room. I pursued her with thoughts of an explanation, but she flew down the drive. And some minutes later, I was able to pick her out with my field glasses, traveling rapidly in a southwesterly direction.
Challenger, any credibility you've gained in my eyes over the last few years has just been shot clean through.
Well, I only tell this anecdote for what it is worth. Has it conveyed anything to your minds? What do you think of it, Lord John?
I think you'll be getting into some serious trouble someday if you don't put a brake on, Professor.
Summerlee?
You should drop all work immediately, Challenger, and take 3 months in a German watering place.
Oh, profound, profound. Now, my young friend, is it possible that wisdom may come from you where your seniors have failed?
Of course, that's it. We're all poisoned.
Precisely. We're all poisoned.
Stuff and nonsense.
Our planet has swum into a very poisoned belt of ether and is now flying deeper and deeper at a rate of some millions of miles a minute. But the symptoms can be checked and controlled. After my little outburst of high spirits, I sat down and reasoned with myself. I put it to myself that I had never before felt impelled to bite anyone of my household. The impulse had then been an abnormal one.
Well, Challenger, what is your opinion as to the present outlook?
It is my opinion, gentlemen, that we will bear witness to the end of the world.
And stuff and nonsense, sir.
Now, listen closely, my friends. Conceive of a bunch of grapes covered by some infinitesimal but noxious bacillus. The gardener passes it through a disinfecting medium, and they are gone. Our gardener is, in my opinion, about to dip the solar system and sterilize we human bacillus that twist and wriggle upon its surface.
And then I put it to you directly. May there not be some fallacy in your information or your reasoning?
None.
Look out of the window. There's the sun shining as brightly as ever in the blue sky. There are the heather and the flowers and the birds, and folks enjoying themselves on the golf links, and the workers in the fields. And you tell us that they and we may be upon the very brink of destruction because of rumors from Sumatra?
Well, we're not nervous folk, and you know that full well, Challenger, but you mean to tell us that what we assumed to be a weekend visit has brought us full bore into Judgment Day?
What was the last news when you left London, Malone?
I was at the Gazette office until about 10. Reuter had just come into the effect that the sickness seemed to be rampant in Sumatra, and that all lighthouses remained unlit.
I am in close touch with both the authorities and the press, so news converges upon me from all parts. From varied accounts, the poison effect begins with mental excitement. The rioting in Paris this morning is said to have been very violent, and the Welsh colliers are in a state of uproar. So far as the evidence at hand can be trusted, symptoms seem to progress reliably through a stimulative stage, succeeded by a certain exaltation and mental lucidity, which, after an appreciable interval, turned to coma, deepening rapidly into death. The progression seems to quite accurately mirror certain vegetable-based nerve poisons.
Gentlemen, if you please, is there no way of warding off the effects of this poison, no antidote?
I fear not, Lord John. Allow me to read from a telegram I received from Marseille at 9:45 this morning. Delirious excitement throughout Provence. A sudden illness attended by coma attacked population this morning. Great numbers dead in the streets. Paralysis of business and universal chaos. I have more of such wires from India and Persia, as well as Austria.
Good Lord, is... what's to be done?
Take our lunch. We have a cook whose omelets are only excelled by her cutlets, and we can but trust that no cosmic disturbance has dulled her excellent abilities.
And indeed, it proved to be a very merry meal. It's true that we could not forget our awful situation. Life, death, faith, and the destiny of man, these were the stupendous subjects discussed in that memorable hour. And as the meal progressed, strange, sudden exultations began to jangle in my mind, and tingling in my limbs proclaimed the invisible tide of death.
If you please, I'll clear these away, sir.
Austin?
Yes, sir.
I thank you for your faithful service.
I have done my duty, sir.
I'm expecting the end of the world today, Austin.
Yes, sir. What time, sir?
Cannot say, Austin. Before evening.
Very good, sir. Will there be anything else?
No, Austin.
It was Mrs. Challenger who finally voiced that question foremost in our minds.
It won't be painful, will it, George?
No, my dear. No more than laughing gas at the dentist's.
But that was a pleasant sensation.
Mm. And so might death be.
Is it quite certain, Challenger, that there is nothing we can do?
To save ourselves? Nothing. But to prolong our lives a few hours more and thus see the evolution of this mighty tragedy? Most definitely.
The oxygen.
Exactly! The oxygen!
But what can oxygen effect in the face of a poisoning of the ether?
My good Summerlee, this etheric poison is most certainly influenced by material agents. I am strongly of the opinion that a gas like oxygen, which increases the vitality and the resisting power of the body, would be extremely likely to delay the poison's effect.
Well, if we got to sit sucking at those tubes like so many babies with their bottles, count me out.
No, there will be no need for that, Lord John, as we have made arrangements. An inspiration we owe chiefly to my wife.
What do you mean?
Oh, we shall render her boudoir airtight using matting and varnished paper.
You don't propose we shall keep out the ether with varnished paper?
Really, Summerlee, sometimes you are damn near perverse at missing the point. It is not to keep the ether out, but the oxygen in. I trust that if we keep a hyper-oxygenated atmosphere, we will be able to retain our senses.
How long will the oxygen last?
I have no idea, dear boy. We will not release the first valve until the symptoms become unbearable. Then we shall dole the gas out as is needed. It may last hours, it may last days. Perhaps now, gentlemen, you will all be so kind as to give me a hand with the cylinders. It seems that the atmosphere about has already grown oppressive.
The chamber that was destined to be the scene of our unforgettable experience was a charmingly feminine sitting room, some 14 or 16 feet square. One door and a window frame had been plastered around with varnished paper so as to be practically sealed.
Two oxygen tubes are ready to be turned on at a moment's notice so that we cannot be taken unawares. At the same time, it would do well not to go far from this room, as the crisis may be a sudden and an urgent one. One moment, please. Yes?
The window overlooked a road curving down the side of the hill. One could see a young nurse wheeling by a perambulator and leading a second child by the hand. The blue trails of smoke from the cottages gave the whole widespread landscape an air of settled order and homely comfort. Nowhere, nowhere in the blue heaven or on the sunlit earth was there a foreshadowing of catastrophe. As a matter of fact, the harvesters were back in the field, and golfers and pairs and foursomes were still streaming around the links. The apparent indifference of these people was simply amazing. These fellows don't seem to feel any ill effects.
Have you ever played golf, Ted?
No, I have not.
Well, young fella, once the game has begun, it would take the crack of doom itself to stop a true golfer.
Yes, thank you, sir. It is much appreciated.
Well, Challenger, what news?
All bad, I fear. Spain and Portugal have fallen silent, and sources tell me no cable messages are being received from South America. North America, in the southern states, after some rioting, succumbed to silence. Belgium, Holland, and Denmark have each in turn been affected. Despairing messages are flashing from every quarter of the globe to the great centers of learning, imploring their advice. Nothing can be done. Yes, one moment. Yes? Oh, Malone, you are wanted.
Hello?
That you, Malone? McArdle here. Malone, there are terrible goings on in London. For God's sake, see if Professor Challenger can suggest anything that can be done.
He can suggest nothing, sir. He regards the crisis as universal and inevitable.
The office has been in perfect pandemonium ever since you left. The staff is insensible. I'm weighed down with heaviness myself. From my window, I can see the people like thick in Fleet Street, judging by the last telegrams. A whole world is.
Mr. McArdle. Mr. McArdle!
Malone, hang up that phone. It's no use.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
More porridge, Papa Bear?
Yes, please, Mama Bear. I think I will.
Careful, Papa Bear. It's hot.
I like it hot, Mama Bear. You know that.
How about you, Baby Bear?
Yes, Mama, please.
Now sit down, Mama Bear. Your porridge is getting cold.
I like it cold, Papa Bear. Sometimes I like it in the pot, 9 days old.
Did you listen to your homework, Baby Bear?
Not yet, Papa. I forgot the website.
Baby Bear, it's AmericanRadioTheater.org. Now write it on the front of your composition book.
AmericanRadioTheater.org. I'll do it right after breakfast.
Now I wonder who that could be.
I hope it's not that little blonde girl again.
Now we return to the poison belt.
Good Lord, do you feel that?
Like a sudden rolling wave, as if we were bathers up to our necks in water.
It's like an invisible hand. It's closing around my throat.
I was conscious of an immense pressure upon my chest. A great tightness within my head, a loud ringing in my ears and bright flashes before my eyes. A blur of movement, and Professor Challenger charged past me snorting like a wounded water buffalo, his face red-purple, hair bristling with his unconscious wife slung over his shoulder. I felt Lord John's fingers of steel upon the collar of my coat, and a moment later I was stretched flat upon the floor while Professor Summerlee attended the door. Mrs. Challenger lay beside me on the floor. Professor Summerlee collapsed into a chair by the window, head dropping nearly to his knees. Then, as in a dream, I saw Professor Challenger, like a monstrous beetle, crawling slowly across the floor. A moment later, I heard the gentle hissing of escaping oxygen. Challenger breathed two or three times with enormous gulps, his lungs roaring as he drew in the vital gas.
It works. My reasoning is justified.
With a tube in his hand, Professor Challenger rushed over to his wife and held it to her face.
Oh, George, I'm so sorry you brought me back. The door to death is indeed, as you said, hung with beautiful, shimmering curtains. Why have you dragged me back?
Because I wish that we make that passage together. We have been together for so many years. It would be sad to fall apart at this supreme moment.
Oh, George.
I trust, good Summerlee, your last doubts have been resolved regarding the blurring in the spectrum, and will concede I am without error.
For now, Challenger. For now.
Ah. We must husband our supply of gas. The atmosphere of the room is now strongly hyper-oxygenated, and I take it none of us feel any distressing symptoms or the urge to crow like a morning cock.
We sat in silence, nervous tension for 5 minutes or more.
observing our own emotions and sensations. I had just begun to fancy that I felt the constriction around my temples again when Mrs. Challenger called out from the sofa that she was fainting. Her husband turned on more gas.
In pre-scientific days, they used to keep a white mouse in every submarine as its more delicate nervous systems gave signs of a vicious atmosphere before sailors perceived it. You, my dear, will be our white mouse.
Oh, how you flatter.
Possibly we have hit upon the correct mixture. When we have ascertained exactly how little will serve, we shall be able to compute how long we may persist. Unfortunately, in resuscitating ourselves, we have already consumed a considerable proportion of this first tank.
Does it really matter? If we have to go, what is the use of holding on? You don't suppose there's any chance for us, do you?
No. No, I do not. Ultimately, we shall all face the inimitable.
Well, then, don't you think there's more dignity in taking the jump and not waiting to be pushed in? If it must be so, I'm for saying our prayers, turning off the gas, and opening that window.
And why not, George? Perhaps Lord John is right, and it's better so.
I most strongly object. When we must die, let us by all means die. But to deliberately anticipate death seems to me to be a foolish and unjustifiable action.
And what does our young friend say?
I think we should see it to the end.
Capital. I'm of the same opinion.
Then, George, if you say so, I cannot object.
Well, well, I'm only putting it as an argument, but if you want to see it through, I'm with you. It's deuced interesting, no mistake about that.
Granting the continuity of life...
A large assumption.
None of us can predict what opportunities of observation one may have as we view the most stupendous event that the world, or the universe, as far as we know it, has ever encountered. To me, it would seem a deplorable thing that we should in any way curtail by so much as a minute so wonderful an experience.
I am strongly of the same opinion.
Ah, capital!
So carried. Ah, Challenger, that poor devil of a chauffeur of yours down in the yard has made his last journey.
No use making a sally to bring him in.
No, it would be absolute madness.
Well, I suppose it would. Yeah, it couldn't help him, and we'd scatter our gas all over the house, even if we got back alive. My word, look at all the little birds under the trees.
Through the window, we noticed that Austin, the chauffeur, had received his final notice at last. He was sprawled beside the wheel with a great black bruise upon his forehead where he'd struck the mudguard while falling. He still held in his hand the cloth with which he had been washing down the machine.
See, that nurse girl took the baby from the perambulator and into her arms and just laid her head on the grassy bank.
And the little boy stretched out on the road just behind her.
On the golf green, 8 bodies sprawled about. They'd held to their game to the last. No bird flew in the blue vault of heaven. No man or beast moved upon the countryside that lay before us.
Look! Oh, look there! A house on fire! There will, I suspect, be many such disasters. Whole cities in flames. When we consider how many folk may have dropped with lights in their hands. There, you see another blaze on top of Crowbrook Hill. It is the golf clubhouse, or I'm not mistaken.
Oh, by George, what's that train of smoke over there? What? It's a train!
We heard the roar of the runaway train. Presently, it came into sight, flying through the station at a most prodigious speed. The express careened along the track and exploded into a hill of splintered wood and twisted iron. Red spurts of flame flickered up from the wreckage until all was ablaze.
Oh, those poor people.
My dear, the passengers on that train were no more animate than the coals into which they crashed, or the carbon which they have now become. It was a train of the living when it left Victoria, but it was driven by the dead long before it reached its fate.
All over the world, the same thing must be going on. Think of the ships at sea, how they will steam on and on until all the furnaces die down, or until they run full tilt upon the beach. The sailing ships, too, how they will back and fill with their cargoes of dead sailors.
while their timbers rot and their joints leak, till one by one they sink below the surface. Perhaps a century hence, the Atlantic may still be dotted with the old drifting derelicts.
The world was empty before us, and under laws which in their inception are beyond and above us, it peopled once before. Why may not the same process happen again?
My dear Challenger, you can't mean that.
I'm not in the habit, Professor Summerly, of saying things I do not mean.
Well, you lived an obstinate dogmatist. Clearly you mean to die one.
And you, sir, have lived an unimaginative obstructionist and never can hope to emerge from it.
Your worst critics will never accuse you of lacking imagination.
Upon my word, it would be just like the two of you if you used up the last of our oxygen in abusing one another. Oh, what can it matter whether folks come back or not? It surely will not be in our time.
In that remark, sir, you betray your own very pronounced limitations. The true scientific mind is not to be tied down by its own conditions of time and space. It builds itself an observatory erected upon the borderline of the present, which separates the infinite past from the infinite future. Am I right, Professor Summerly?
With certain reservations, I agree.
It strikes me nature's on top this time. I've read some leading articles about you gentlemen controlling her, but with this, she's getting a bit back of her own.
It is but a temporary setback. A few million years, what are they in the great cycle of time? Once the lowest form of life has established itself, something from the vegetable world, most likely, the final advent of man is as certain as the growth of the oak from the acorn. The old circle will swing around once more.
And with that, the smoking house behind the trees burst into flame.
Oh, it's pretty awful.
Well, after all, what does it matter? The world is dead. Cremation is surely the best burial.
It would shorten us up if this house went ablaze.
Oh, George, I feel my head begins to throb again.
Mine as well, Challenger.
Well, we must change it then. It's nearly empty. But it has lasted us some 3 hours. We shall get through the night comfortably. I should expect the end at about 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. We shall see one last sunrise, which shall be ours alone.
The strange thing is that I find it impossible to feel grief for those who are gone. They're my father and mother in Bedford. I know they are dead, and yet I can feel no sharp sorrow, even for them.
A universal death must, in its nature, be far less terrible than an isolated one.
It's the same in battle. If you saw a single man lying on the floor with his chest knocked in, it would turn you sick. But I've seen 10,000 on their backs in the Sudan, and it gave me no such feeling. For when you are making history, the life of any man is too small a thing to worry about.
Even so, the inimitable is frightening.
Yeah, well, you'll be the bravest of us all, my dear, when the time comes. I've been a blusterous old husband to you, but you'll just bear in mind that G.E. Challenger is as he was made. And couldn't help himself. After all, you wouldn't have had anyone else.
No one in the whole wide world, my love.
Darkness fell on the dead world, was shrouded in gloom. But right across the southern horizon was one long, vivid scarlet streak, leaping suddenly to a crimson zenith and then dying down to a glowing line of fire. Loses the blaze, I cried.
No, it's a brightening. You can see the curved back of the downs against the glow. That fire is miles on the farther side of it.
There were several red glares at different points, but they all seemed mere pinpoints of light compared to that monstrous conflagration beyond the hills. Suddenly, the old instinct to record came over me. If these men of science could be so true to their life's work to the very end, why should not I? Besides, taking notes would help to pass the weary hours and to occupy my thoughts. Professor Challenger had spent a greater part of the night seated at the center table with the electric light illuminating the slide under his microscope. The small, vivid circle of white light from the mirror left half his face in brilliant radiance, the other in deepest shadow.
Summerlee, will you kindly step across and satisfy me with a point? Malone, will you kindly verify? Now, as you peer into the finder, Summerlee, you will note on the right-hand side an amoeba moving sluggishly across the field of vision.
Oh, what can it matter if the amoeba is alive or not?
It matters a great deal, my dear.
I'm with Mrs. Challenger. Why should we attach such great importance to the creature being alive, since it shares the same atmosphere with us in this room?
This specimen was mounted yesterday and was hermetically sealed. None of our oxygen can reach it. But the ether, of course, has penetrated to it, as to every other point upon the universe.
Therefore, it has survived the poison.
Precisely. Therefore, we may argue that every amoeba outside this room, instead of being dead, has really survived the catastrophe.
Well, even now, I don't feel inclined to hip hurrah about it. What does it matter?
Simply this. The world we are living in is not dead. Millions of years hence, a mere passing moment in the enormous flux of ages, the whole world teeming once more with the animal and human life which will spring from this tiny root.
Funny little chap to hang number one amongst the family portraits.
You seem to take it for granted, Challenger, this monstrous conceit of mankind, that all this stage was erected for him alone to strut upon.
We cannot be dogmatic about it, but at least what you have ventured to call a monstrous conceit, we can surely say that we are the highest thing in nature.
As far as we know, man only came into being yesterday, as the geological clock goes. Why then should it be taken for granted that all this stupendous preparation was for his benefit?
For those, then, or for what?
How can we tell? The scum upon the surface of the ocean imagine that the ocean was created in order to produce and sustain it. Or a mouse in a cathedral may think the building its own proper ordained residence.
I jotted down the very words to their argument, but it ultimately degenerated into a noisy wrangle with much polysyllabic scientific jargon volleyed from each side. Brighton was still blazing and the air became flavored with a great melancholy. At 3:30 a.m. I awoke with a start. The first cold light of dawn was just stealing into the room, making everything gray and mournful. The human race was gone, extinguished in a day. But the planets swing around and the tides rise and fall and nature goes her way, down, as it would seem to be the very amoeba, with never a sign that he who styled himself the Lord of creation had ever blessed or cursed the universe with his presence.
George, I'm stifling.
It's all right, Mrs. Challenger. I'll just turn on a fresh supply.
The fifth and the last. How long, Challenger?
Possibly 3 hours.
I used to be frightened, but the nearer I get to it, the easier it seems.
I confess that I should have liked another year to finish my classification of chalk fossils.
I suspect that we all left some loose ends sticking out. What are yours, young fellow?
Well, I was working on a book of verses.
Well, the world has escaped that, at least.
Charitable to the last.
Oh, there's always compensation somewhere if you grope around.
And what about you? What are your loose ends, Lord John?
Well, it just so happens that I was tied up and ready. I promised to chum a safari to Tibet to track a snow leopard in the spring. What of you, Mrs.?
Oh, I would have been grateful for just one more walk with George upon those beautiful downs. Do you hear?
Oh, that cylinder. It's not lasting too well.
My dear, sit on this stool at my knee and give me your hand. I think, my friends, that a further delay in this insufferable atmosphere is hardly advisable. You would not desire it, would you, my dear?
No, George, of course not.
I'm all for a header and have done with it.
You would open the window and face the ether?
Better to be poisoned than stifled.
Challenger, we've had our quarrels, but that's all over now.
We were good friends and had respect for each other under the surface. Goodbye.
Goodbye, young fella. Window's plastered up. You can't open it.
Give me that field glass, Malone. Into the hands of the power that made us, we render ourselves again!
And with those words, Professor Challenger hurled the field glasses through the window. Full in our flushed faces before the last tinkle of falling fragments had died away, came the wholesome breath of the wind. Strong and sweet. I don't know how long we sat in amazed silence.
Am I still alive?
We are back to normal conditions. The world has cleared the poison belt.
But we alone of all mankind are saved.
I remember how we all sat, gasping in our chairs with that sweet, wet breeze, fresh from the sea, flapping the muslin curtains and cooling our flushed faces. We were bewildered, stunned, semi-conscious. We had all braced our courage for death, but now we had to face this new and fearful fact, that we would live after our entire race was obliterated. What in the world are we to do with our lives?
There'll be nothing and no one left to shoot, and no more soldiering, so there's an end to my calling.
And there are no more students, so there's an end to mine.
Science is not dead, Summerlee, and this catastrophe in itself will offer us many absorbing problems for investigation. Consider, Professor, it was about 3 PM yesterday that the world entered the poison belt. The question is, at what hour did we pass out of it?
Well, we know the air was very bad as of 8 o'clock this morning, as I distinctly felt the same choking in my throat that came at the onset.
Then we shall say we passed through the belt just after 8 o'clock. Therefore, for 17 hours, the world was soaked in poisonous ether. Is it possible that others may have survived besides us?
Well, that's what I was wondering. Why should we be the only pebbles left on the beach?
Stuff and nonsense. Consider that the poison was so virulent that a man as strong as an ox with not a nerve in his body, or someone like Challenger here, could hardly step 3 paces before he nearly fell unconscious. Do you think it likely anyone could stand 17 minutes off it, much less hours?
Unless someone saw it coming and made some preparation as we did.
That, I think, is hardly probable. The anticipatory imagination that enabled me to foresee the danger is unlikely to be seen twice in the same generation.
Then you conclude that everyone is certainly dead?
There is little doubt of this, my dear.
What's done is done. No insult to the missus, but I'm sick and tired of this confinement, as feminine as it may be. I think it'd be wise to stretch our legs and have a breath of fresh air and look over this strange new graveyard we've inherited.
I concur.
But not from this little country village. We've seen from this window all the place has to teach us. We should make for London.
And with Lord John at the wheel of the Challenger's touring car, we sped off upon the strangest drive that ever human beings had taken since man first came upon the earth.
I'll tell you this, young fellow. I never thought I'd live to take the whole of the human race out for a drive.
Picture the loveliness of nature upon that August day. The freshness of the morning air, the golden glow of the summer sunshine, and the luxuriant green of the Sussex woods. The deep purple of the heather-clad downs. But as you address this scene in your mind, also be conscious of the solemn, all-embracing silence. Not the slightest hum of life. Not the twitter of birds, the buzz of insects, the far-off echo of voices, the lowing of cattle, rattle of carts. Nothing, nothing but deadly, appalling silence. And then there were the dead. At first, the endless groups of drawn and grinning faces filled me with shuddering horror. The nurse upon the hill with the 2 babes in her arms, the old horse on his knees between the shafts. Above him, the cabman twisted across the seat. The young man inside the cab, his hand upon the open door, caught in the very act of springing to the ground. When we reached the outskirts of London, the horror overtook my ability to retain the imagery. Individuals merged into groups and groups into crowds, crowds becoming a universal phenomenon of devastation.
Pretty doings, eh, what?
Roxton! Roxton, stop the car! Oh. Look there, out of the window of that corner house. Is that not a woman's arm waving a handkerchief?
Indeed, it was a woman. She sat in a chair by the open window. Laid across a second chair was a cylinder of oxygen, like those that had saved our own lives. An invalid, she turned her bespectacled face to us as we crowded in at her doorway.
I feared that I was abandoned here forever.
Well, madam, it is a lucky chance that we happened to pass.
I have one all-important question to ask you, gentlemen, and I beg you, be frank with me. What effect will these events have upon my Northwestern Railway shares?
Mrs. Burston, for that was her name, was an asthmatic, and oxygen having been prescribed for her malady. She had survived the night by carefully doling her supply, as we had. We saw to it that she was comfortable and promised to communicate with her in a couple of days at the latest. We left her, weeping bitterly over her vanished stock.
Oh, I confess I do not see what more we can hope for here.
We passed the newspaper cart, its placard bearing in large block letters, "Is this the end? Great scientist warning correct, and Professor Challenger justified."
Oh, in the limelight to the last, my dear.
So it would appear.
But, Lord John, please stop the car.
What's wrong?
A rare moment of inspiration. From the car, I spied St. Mary's Church. Its bell tower stood like a lighthouse above a dead sea. We carefully made our way through the sanctuary, crammed with figures collapsed into every posture of supplication and abasement. I made my way to the corner of the church where hung the ropes for the bell ringers. I pulled hard, surprised at the weight of the great bell. In moments, Lord John, Professor Summerlee, and Professor Challenger added their weight to mine, and we heard the great roaring and clanging above us. For half an hour we worked, the sweat popping from our faces, our arms and backs aching with exertion. We then went into the portico and looked out eagerly upon the silent, crowded streets, but there was not a sound, not a motion in response to our summons. It's no use, it's no use. No one is left.
We can do nothing more. For God's sake, George, let us get back to Rotherfield. Another hour here and I shall go mad.
Now I come to the end of this extraordinary incident, so overshadowing in its importance, not only in our individual lives, but in the general history of the human race. We now know that at any moment we may pass through the poison ether again, and that grim presence shadows our lives.
There is some clash of opinion as to the exact hour of the Great Awakening.
It is generally agreed that, apart from the difference of clocks, there may have been local causes which influenced the action of the poison.
Certainly in each separate district, the resurrection was practically simultaneous.
In our own case, there can be no doubt whatsoever. For in Professor Challenger's study, the chronometer was always carefully adjusted.
The time was 6:15.
Upon returning to the Challenger estate, an enormous depression began to weigh upon my spirits. Was it possible to exist upon a dead world? It was as I brooded upon this last dreadful idea that a slight noise caused me to glance at the road beyond the open study window to see the old cab horse making its way over the hill.
At the same instant, we were conscious of the twittering birds, someone coughing, and a flurry of movement across the landscape.
The absurd, emaciated cab horse slowly wheezed its way up the slope. The driver sitting hunched over upon the box, and the young man leaning out of the window in some excitement and shouting to the driver.
They were all indubitably, aggressively alive.
Everyone was alive once more. Had it all been a delusion? Was it conceivable that this whole poison belt incident had been an elaborate dream?
For an instant, my startled brain was ready to believe just that, and then I looked down, and there, rising on my palm, was the blister made by the rope of the church bell.
The world had resuscitated.
Here was life come back to the planet in an instant, full tide.
My eyes wandered over the landscape. I saw it in every direction. Movement, glorious movement, life, picking up in the very same groove in which it had halted.
Everyone had unconcernedly taken up the thread at the very point where they had dropped it.
I heard the voices of my companions loud in astonishment and congratulations in the yard. I rushed outside.
But they could not have all been asleep.
Dash it all, Challenger. You don't mean to tell me you believe that these folks were asleep.
It can only be a condition akin to catalepsy, a rare phenomenon in the past frequently mistaken for death. While it endures, the body's temperature falls, respiration disappears, the heartbeat is undetectable. In fact, it is death, save that it is evanescent, even to the most comprehensive of minds.
Call it what you will, Challenger. We still know as little of the result as we do of the poison that caused it.
Young fathead. Can't leave things well enough alone.
What's the matter, Austin?
It's the automobile, sir. The lubricator's been left running. Someone has been fooling with the car, and I suspect it's that young garden boy, sir. Ooh, my neck is stiff. I don't know what's missed with me, sir. I came over all queer when I was hosing the car down. I seem to remember flopping over the running board. But I swear to you, sir, I never left those lubricator taps on.
And so it will be with the entire human race. They all felt swimmy for a moment, and then all went black. None of them have the foggiest comprehension of what has occurred over the last 28 hours. Each will go on with his interrupted life as Austin when he snatched up his hose.
And it is here I must bring this narrative to an end. Within hours, the headlines ran.
28-hour world in coma. Unprecedented experience.
Challenger justified.
Our correspondent escapes.
Enthralling narrative of this oxygen room.
Challenger justified.
Weird motor drive through dead London.
Great fires and loss of life. Will it recur?
Challenger justified.
Challenger and Summerlee have threatened to treat the matter in an unprecedented joint scientific work.
Challenger justified!
The initial draft of which has yet to see the light of day.
Come now, Summerlee. Be not so inflexible.
That's stuff and nonsense, I say.
But
you haven't taken into account.
But to me has been left the transcription of the popular account.
My dear Summerlee, it is vital to the interest of science we compile the most accurate record possible.
Our human species are a feeble lot before the infinite powers around us. In these times of modern medicine and great armored weapons of war, we have lost sight of our fragility, our vulnerability.
Oh, Professor, humor him just this once, will you?
Perhaps a lesson was needed to demonstrate our ignorance and complacency as to just how narrow is our path of material existence. May this poison belt through which we have passed be the foundation upon which a wiser and more reverent race be built. Oh, Professor, be a sport.
Oh, very well.
You've been listening to American Radio Theater's presentation of Arthur Conan Doyle's The Poison Belt, adapted for radio by Cole Hornaday. It was directed by David Van Meter and produced by Joy Jackson. In our cast, you heard Ivan Curry as Ted Malone, Kim Turner as Mr. McCardle and the Porter, Cole Hornaday as Professor Challenger, Greg Porter as Professor Summerlee, Renard LaBeouf as Lord John Roxton, Brian Hendrickson as Austin the Chauffeur, Melinda Maines was Mrs. Challenger, and Joan Parker was Mrs. Burston. Pat McNally was the telegraph boy. Sound effects by Al Gill, Penny Swanberg, and Pat McNally. Engineering by Ron Ailey and Mike Wheeler. Music by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. I'm Joy Jackson, and this is ART, the American Radio Theater. Gee, that's all the time I have for today. Please stop by our website, www.AmericanRadioTheater.org, for more of our podcasts. We put up a new one every month. Hey, see you next time. Over to you, Louise.
Okay, Joy. Thanks a lot and great work as usual. Now,
it's time for me to become the bad boy of MSS, because it is that time again when I have to wrap things up and shut things down for this week's broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. But not to worry, we will be back again next week, and you know how to find us, where to find us, and when to find us. So, as usual, if you have any questions, complaints, requests, maybe even a comment or two, please address them not to me, because I won't be getting those emails, but to MikeAmeli@earthlink.net. Yes, the MSS director. He can be found at MikeEarthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and returning the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.